My name's Matt Crosman. I'm the lead pastor here at ECV. And if you have been with us, you know something about what's been going on. We've been in this kind of little mini-series called The City That Is to Come. It's kind of an epilogue to our main fall series, Following Jesus in the City. Basically, what we've been doing is we've been considering together what it means to live by faith. What it means to live in an orientation of hope towards what is not yet seen. What it means to live oriented towards what the text we've been looking at calls the city that is to come, the city whose architect and builder is God. And how learning to think that way and learning to live that way changes the way that we think about the costs of following Jesus as we come to understand the reward, right? The kind of what lies ahead for us, that relationship with God through Jesus. This week we come to actually the end of the ancient sermon that we've been reading. This is the New Testament book of Hebrews. Come to chapter 13. Just to briefly summarize, if Hebrews 11 is basically about the definition of faith and kind of like a history of people who've been trying to live by faith, and Hebrews 12 introduces us to Jesus, who we're supposed to understand as the author and perfecter of our faith, whom we should imitate, Hebrews 13 really finally gets down to, like, those are like huge things, right? Hebrews 13 really gets down to the nitty-gritty. The ancient preacher spends much of chapter 13, I just want to warn you in advance, telling us what to do. May or may not be super comfortable with that, so get ready for that. Really, I think, encouraging us, exhorting us to live in ways that actually give us life, and so we'll talk about that. And so this week is right down to the details, and perhaps it's of any of the kind of weeks we've been in this little mini-series, it'll be really at kind of ground level, thinking about, even bringing us back to thinking a little bit about New Haven, this city that we happen to live in, and what God might be doing here. And so the question really that's, I think, driving this talk is this: what does the city that is to come, this kind of heavenly city that we've heard a little bit about in Hebrews, what does that have to do with this city right here, the one that we live in, work in, go to school in? And how would God have us live in this city here, as citizens of that city, of the city that is to come? And I think by the end, we'll have a better sense of why it is that the life of faith forms us uniquely to be suited to building a great city here in New Haven for all people. So basically, the talk will go like this. I'm going to go through, I'll admit, as I have every week, there's too much in this text to really go to here in detail. So you will see, I will skip some things as they come. But really, we'll take a look at a few of the exhortations, right? The commands, the things that Hebrews is telling us to do. And then we'll look at a few and we'll kind of take a step back and say, all right, what's going on with this kind of city and what does it have to do with our city? We can jump in on the text here. This is where, if we were biblical scholars, we would call this paranesis, where he suddenly starts telling us what to do. You have to have a fancy word, because you can't just say the part where he tells us what to do. All right. Here's what he has to say. Let mutual love continue. Do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers, for by doing that, some have entertained angels without knowing it. All right, that is one of those things I will not talk about, except to tell you this, that at least if you want to go find one of these instances, you can look in Genesis 19, Abraham's nephew Lot does this. Entertain some people, they turn out to be angels, it goes well for him. I don't think that's not the reason I'm going to tell us that we should take what he has to say about hospitality seriously, though I suppose that's a good reason. Remember those who are in prison as though you were in prison with them, those who are being tortured as though you yourselves were being tortured. Again, I'm flagging things. I will not talk too much about that. We should visit people in prison. I've done it, and it's like an experience that one should have. We should have some kind of sense of solidarity with folks who are, as this letter is talking about, suffering for the sake of their faith. So many good things that are in this letter that we will not talk about today. All right, we will talk about this. Let marriage be held in honor by all, and let the marriage bed be kept undefiled, for God will judge fornicators and adulterers. Straight up. Keep your lives free from the love of money, and be content with what you have, for he, you understand that this is the Lord, has said, I will never leave you or forsake you. So we can say with confidence, the Lord is my helper. I will not be afraid. What can anyone do to me? All right. So let's take a look at some of these exhortations one at a time. The first one is this: let mutual love continue. And this is great. The first time I told you that I really got into this text when taking a Greek exegesis class of this class, which you read the text in Greek and translate it and talk about it. My translation of the sentence said, let Philadelphia remain. Capitalized Philadelphia, just to have fun with it. It's literally what it says, right? Let mutual love, let Philadelphia, brotherly love, let it remain. Let it continue. And I think that this is actually the theme of the whole chapter. This is the theme. And as it turns out, the life of faith is a life of love. The life of faith, the sojourning in life, in assurance of the things hoped for and conviction of things unseen, right? That life is a life of love. So mutual love is what we're talking about. Love for one another, love in a family, love among brothers and brothers and sisters. But I don't know about you, but one of the first things I start to ask is like, well, are we just talking about brotherly love? Which is, I think, the way we'd more literally translate this. Like, is that like just for the folks who are inside? Like, what are the bounds of this family? Who should we be loving? And I think that's what the second command tries, or second kind of exhortation tries to get us at, right? Do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers. And I think this is actually absolutely crucial here. And actually, I want to suggest that if we're about loving our city and helping it step into the future that we've been talking about, this future that it has in relationship with Jesus, hospitality, I don't just mean like, I don't know about you, but sometimes like hospitality can seem like a relatively kind of trivial thing, right? I don't know. I think we should take hospitality really, really seriously. I think hospitality may be actually like the key to following Jesus and blessing people in our city. Hospitality may be the key to following Jesus because hospitality fundamentally transforms the significance of otherness. Hospitality transforms the significance of otherness. And encounter with otherness is perhaps the distinctive feature of life in the city. Hospitality, I was thinking about this, I think hospitality is the disposition by which otherness becomes a reason for fellowship rather than alienation, honor rather than suspicion, right? Hospitality is the rule that says, like, honor goes to the guest, the one who doesn't belong, right? I mean, this is a remarkable thing. And I think if we take that deeply enough in the way that that Hebrews is trying to have us think about it, hospitality is a revolutionary kind of instinct. Hospitality allows us to adopt a disposition where encounters with the other are embraced as opportunities for transformation and opportunities to bless and to honor. An instinct towards hospitality fundamentally shapes the kind of mutual love with which this chapter begins. Because if hospitality is to characterize this love, then it is not merely a love that is oriented only to those who are kind of like on the inside. If this is brotherly love, if it's brotherly love, then the category brother, right, just got like the doors blown off of it, right? This is a large embrace of people as brother, as family. And in fact, I think we'll find by the end that an orientation of faith, of trust, an orientation of hope towards what is yet not seen always is going to allow us to love across dividing walls in ways that we couldn't otherwise. And so we'll come back to hospitality. I think it's actually a theme, a crucial point for what's happening in this chapter. The next exhortation is this one: let marriage be held in honor by all. And it goes on, and let the marriage bed be kept undefiled, for God will judge fornicators and adulterers. Now that, again, this he is speaking in ways that we may not be accustomed to in our culture. He's speaking directly and this challenging text, right? He's not holding his cards very close to the vest here. And perhaps the most striking part, the striking thing to me, is that Hebrews actually considers the honor accorded to marriage to be something that is the concern of all. Let marriage be held in honor by all. Honoring marriage seems to be understood to be a very public concern, a concern that isn't just like a kind of a personal thing. And while we might be inclined, and I apologize in advance for the examples here, we might be inclined to think of marriage as a very private matter. One could think of Jim and Pam's private kind of pre-marriage ceremony on The Office, or of Derek and title character. What's her name? Oh, you just got caught. Meredith on Grey's Anatomy, right? Like the post-it note marriage, right? It just happens. Like, found like fan, when I was trying to get a picture of this, I found like fan websites, like, you know, up in arms about this. You can't have such a cheap marriage. Anyway, but it actually struck me as I started stop to think about it, just how much marriage, especially like on television, as is represented to us, as we're kind of thinking about it together as a culture, marriage is intensely privatized. It's an intensely private thing. And so while we might be inclined to think of marriage as a very private concern, Hebrews seems to have no such instinct. And Hebrews is similarly convinced that sex has substantial public consequences. In fact, I would submit to you that nowhere in the Bible will you ever find the idea of an individual person's sex life. This is just not a concept the Bible knows anything about. Whomever you sleep with is just simply not your kind of private matter. Sex and marriage are intimately intertwined for the biblical authors, and both are public issues with public consequences. And certainly on the level of some kind of like public consequences, I think we can probably identify with this, right? We can see civic consequences of broken marriages, overwhelmed single parents or largely single moms, fatherless children, a culture of distrust when it comes to relational intimacy. Comedian Dimitri Martin says regarding one of our culture's most kind of puzzling inventions, he talks about prenuptial agreements, and he says, "Still the greatest way to say, I love you, but I don't trust you." I think we can kind of see some of the public costs here. And there may be some wisdom to seeing marriage as a public good, as a good that is outside, just, you know, just good for people other than just the two who are engaged in that marriage. But I have to admit, I struggle to imagine what it would look like to make honoring marriage a priority of all, a priority of every person. What would it mean for marriage to be held in honor by all? What kind of honor ought a single person, for example, accord to marriage? What would that look like? And it's made me stop and think a little bit about some of the interactions that I've had in this community, interactions in which it's become clear that even my own marriage, but Hannah and my marriage, is not just our concern, that there are actually other people here who care about it. Because when I stop and think about it, I actually think, like, actually, maybe we're actually starting to take some steps in this direction already. A few weeks back, Alyssa had borrowed my old computer, and while she was doing something with it on a Friday evening, my calendar popped up a reminder to her, date night, which is interesting. But Friday nights, indeed, are Hannah and my date night, and we try to put it on the calendar to make it happen. And Alyssa, having kind of had this little window into our lives, asked us, "Hey, you have a new baby. How's date night going?" We're like, interesting you should ask. It's certainly a challenge with a newborn. And so we talked a little bit about that. And then a few weeks later, we got an email from her and Tina and Shyla insisting that Junia come over as soon as possible for her first ever slumber party, right? That's right. My daughter is popular. She's going to go to a slumber party before she's 6 months old. And we haven't had time to schedule that yet, but we're really excited about this. Like, what a blessing to our marriage. And of course, Tina, Shyla, and Alyssa aren't the only ones who've made those kinds of offers. It doesn't help that my daughter is objectively the cutest baby on the face of the planet in that regard. But even like offers to babysit, I think, are not the only kind of ways that we've seen our marriage like honored in this community. I've seen that in other ways as well, in the group of guys that meet with me every Friday morning to talk about together about how we're doing and loving our wives well. Similarly, in the group of women that meet regularly with Hannah every week. So like I said, I think this is something that we're already doing to some degree, but I've been wondering, how can we walk further into this? How can we help parents find time to spend together apart from their kids, right? How can we help people in serious dating relationships discern God's leading as they consider marriage? How can we teach one another, even across life stages, what we're learning as we walk out life in various kinds of relationships? How can we honor marriage as a community and in our community? I think we've taken some steps, and we certainly have room to grow, and we should do that. But I also think, kind of invoking that hospitality principle that I think transforms this entire chapter, the kind of principle of mutual love and concern in a broader sphere, how can we honor marriage in our city? What would it look like to honor the marriages of our neighbors and our classmates and our coworkers? Mightn't that be the way that to have marriage held in honor by all? Not by berating people for not honoring marriage, as I think too often has been kind of like the way that that's been like the church's voice in the public discourse. And not by going out and saying, you're doing it wrong for X, Y, and Z reason, but perhaps by laying down our lives for the sake of the marriages around us. I was just thinking as I was reading this text, and there was a marriage on our street this summer that was going through a hard enough time that there were kind of quite public signs, arguments in the street that would let even people like Hannah and I, who didn't know this family very well, that there was something serious going on in this marriage. And I don't know how many times I thought to myself that I should just go invite this husband just out to breakfast to talk about the challenges of being married and just see if we could encourage one another. I could encourage him. But there were differences. He was from a different culture, a different religious community, and is always the case here in New Haven for so many of us. I was just busy. So I never did that, that marriage actually ended before the summer was out this summer. And I'm not saying that it was, it was obviously not on me to save that marriage, and maybe it was past the point of saving by the time that the disagreements had become kind of public to the degree that someone as distant from it as me could know something about it. But it's made me think, how can Hannah and I actually be a blessing to our neighbors by honoring their marriages, by praying for them, by looking to encourage them in some particular way? And I'm just at the beginning of wondering about this, but I've been thinking, like, how can we do that to proactively try to bless and encourage people in their marriages? I mean, I know there's been some conversation in ECV for some time about creating some kind of space for people to seek support and encouragement in their marriages and in their parenting. I think the moms group is in some ways, like, I think already a good space for that. We've seen something like that happen. I know there are more casual things like play groups and other groups where there are kind of similar kinds of spaces to talk about these things. And of course, those spaces that we might host, it would only be a blessing to the people that would come into them, to the extent to which that we're actually ourselves being transformed and pursuing God's transforming work in our lives. So we're planning a marriage conference for early next calendar year, and so if you are married, you should keep an eye out for that. And in the meantime, let's see where God leads us. Because how can we hold marriage in honor? In our own marriages, in our community life together, married folk and single folk, and also in our city more broadly, with our neighbors, their friends.
Anyway, the next encouragement: keep your lives free from the love of money.
Now, I've talked at least a little bit about money every week in this series. And that's, if you've been around here for long, you know that's not normally the case. If you haven't been around here for long, you should know that that's not always the case. It just keeps coming up in this text. And I take it that that's because how we deal with our money, how the kinds of decisions that we make about how we deal with our money, reveal a lot about us and about where our hearts truly lie, what our values really are. Now, we've been talking about that in connection to like the life of faith, but my hunch is on this particular way of talking about it, keep your life free from the love of money, that there's probably no one here, regardless of your kind of relationship to the life of faith, there's no one here that I have to work too hard to convince that you shouldn't have your life ruled by a love of money, right? There probably isn't anyone here who really desires to have their life completely controlled by the love of money. So I think the more important question is, how do we actually live life free from money's grasp? Last week, I gave you two rules from Gary Best for how to live an integrated life, a life of integrity. And this week, I want to give you a couple of rules of my own, just things that I found helpful in order to kind of like keep my life free from the love of money. And they're super simple. The first rule is this: if you want to keep your life free from the love of money, first thing you can do is you can give it away. That's simple, but I think crucial. Give it away. Just give it away. Money loses its control over us when we give it away. And to some extent, it doesn't even matter where. It doesn't even matter to whom you give it. When you give your money away, it loses its ability to control your life. And even more so, as you decide ahead of time to give your money away, even money that you haven't yet made, that hasn't yet come into your hands, starts to kind of lose its control over you. When Hannah and I first got married, I had been teaching music lessons in order to just kind of like make ends meet, pay the bills. And as we both started taking on full-time jobs and getting paid, we started to realize, well, we don't need this income anymore. But I found that even though I didn't need the money anymore, I still wanted the money, right? Which is a problem because, what we didn't need was money. What we certainly needed was the time that I was spending teaching the lessons. I was, as I have mentioned before, so often the case during my life, rather busy. Actually a rather destructive thing in one's life, but it was the reality at the time. And so I kept teaching those lessons, partially because I enjoyed teaching, and partially because I enjoyed, right, like having money. I admit it, like I like money. And so I was doing this, and these mixed motives made it really hard to kind of figure out how to say yes or how to say no, and kind of to whom do I keep certain students, or I take new students on? How do I kind of balance this part of my life with the other things that I really value, making time for my wife, making time for my community, for ministry? So we said, like, this is ridiculous. Like, why is money a factor? Like, we don't need the money. Why is this the factor in what we're doing? So we just decided to make a commitment. Every penny that I was going to make from music lessons, we would give away. And so we accounted for it separately, and we made sure at the end of every month and at the end of every year that that little category was at zero. Whatever had come in had gone back out and blessed good things that God was doing around the world. So to some extent, it was like, well, done. And that was easy. Really, I mean, all of a sudden, there was no conflict. I had no economic incentive to teach music lessons. I could simply decide on the grounds that I wanted to, right? I could just ask, God, how would you have me use this time? Actually, for the students that I did keep on, it was great to show up at their houses and be like, not only am I going to teach you a lesson, but there's money going to fund my friend doing this other thing. Like, it was great. I think it's the beauty and the power of the pre-made decision, which is so, so important in our lives. So this is why, and honestly, I mean it, regardless of to whom you give your money, it is good for you to give it away. It is good for me to be parted from my money, because as it goes, it loses its power over me. But of course, I'd be remiss if I didn't say there's extra good, I think, to be found in actually giving your money to good things. So all things being equal, give your money to the poor. That's always a strong move. Or you give it to an organization that is investing in God's good work. You can give it here in ECV. We're invested in giving money to the poor and investing in the things that God is doing in the world. You can help us invest in the things that God is doing here in ECV, in our city, and around the world. But I think that's the first step. Give it away. The second step is this. Consider all of what you have God's. After you give away as much money as you can, Jesus suggested that you start with a minimum of 10%. After you've done that, consider even what you keep to be God's. Consider even what you keep to be God's, to be used for God's purposes on the earth, for the things that God is doing in the world, bringing freedom, justice, mercy, compassion, and the like. So we've kind of tried to turn our language a little bit around this way. I try to look at it this way. I should say, I never buy myself anything. I don't buy myself food or clothing. I didn't buy myself my computer. I didn't buy myself my car. We didn't buy ourselves our house. The way I want to think about it is this. I used God's funds, which he had entrusted to me, to buy God food, clothing, a computer, a car, a house. And that might sound a little bit ridiculous, but I think that actually changes both my purchasing decisions, right? Because it means that every purchase is actually a kind of a stewardship event. Because I'm not spending my money, and what I'm buying won't be mine. I need to think about the values of the one whose money it is and what he would have me use it for. And because these things are God's, they are able to be used generously for God's purposes. And hopefully, you know, hopefully feeding myself, clothing myself, like sustaining my life. Hopefully those are like investments in God's work. So those uses are fine. But more central, perhaps, even, is would be purposes of hospitality and generosity, to use God's stuff to bless people whom God loves. So, you know, so we try to regularly loan our car out to facilitate good things that God's doing in our world. And we've had folks who've needed a place to stay, say, in our apartment or in our house, given the fact that, of course, they're not ours. Because it's not really our car, not really our house. These are God's resources to be used for God's purposes. And Caleb, my friend Caleb, sent me a text message the other day. He was on his way down to the recent Vineyard conference on blessing Muslims, our Muslim neighbors locally and globally. And though Hannah and I couldn't go to the conference, he was riding down to the conference. I don't know who was driving it, Gideon or someone. He was riding in our car down to the conference in New Jersey. And on the way, Caleb sent me this text. He said, "Riding in God's car to the conference." Awesome. I was like, yes, good. We've got the point. It's God's car, and God's people needed to go to New Jersey. So that was a good thing. Look, I'm convinced that if we start to live this way, then I think we're actually done with the love of money. But Hebrews knows this is not easy, and so it gives us a sense of what this, how we're actually going to be able to do this. It's because of the promise of God, right? This is in line with Hebrews' concern with faith, right? Hebrews says that the key is the promise of God, a promise never to leave us or forsake us, so that then we can say with confidence, "The Lord is my helper. I will not be afraid. What can anyone do to me?" It is the abundance of God's provision that allows us to engage in near reckless generosity and hospitality. All right, finally, in case you've forgotten, the ancient preacher reminds us, of kind of ties this whole thing together, and reminds us, and begins so by reminding us of the crucial importance of models, those whose influence on us is like available to us right here, in the here and the now, those whose stories influence us, even though they are no longer with us, and of course, the most important model, Jesus, right, the author and perfecter of our faith. So the text goes on, and we'll read a fair bit of it here. And again, I will pass over things that if you have questions, come ask me about later. "Remember your leaders, those who spoke the word of God to you. Consider the outcome of their way of life and imitate their faith. Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. Do not be carried away by all kinds of strange teachings, for it is well for the heart to be strengthened by grace, not by regulations about food, which have not benefited those who observe them." This is a practical issue going on in the community that this was originally written to. "We have an altar from which those who officiate in the tent have no right to eat, for the bodies of those animals whose blood is brought into the sanctuary by the high priest as a sacrifice for sin are burned outside the camp. Therefore, Jesus also suffered outside the city gate in order to sanctify the people by his own blood. Let us then go to him outside the camp and bear the insult he endured. For here we have no lasting city, but we are looking for the city that is to come. Through him, then, let us continually offer a sacrifice of praise to God, that is the fruit of lips that confess his name. Do not neglect to do good and to share what you have, for such sacrifices are pleasing to God." Imitation, right, has been the name of the game and remains the name of the game for Hebrews. Imitation is the name of the game, and the man to be most imitated is Jesus. And so as we think about, as we kind of wrap up a rather lengthy season that we've been in, we won't leave it behind, but as we've been in this season of thinking about how Jesus would have us relate to our city, we find in this text that actually Jesus has a relationship to the city. And his relationship to the city leads us to the core of the significance of the motif, the city that is to come, which we've been hearing about for several chapters now. And that is this: Jesus died outside the city for the sake of the city. And both parts of that are crucial. Jesus was not beholden to his earthly city. He was not afraid to stand apart from it. He was ultimately rejected, and he knew that it was not his home. But nevertheless, Jesus did not simply stand at a distance from his city and from the people and condemn them. Jesus goes outside the city for the sake of the city, to sanctify the people, to set them apart for relationship with God. And this is the man whom we are to imitate. For we, Hebrews tells us, are actually like him. For we too here have no lasting city, but we are looking for the city that is to come. We've been talking about this for several weeks now. But you might, from what we've read recently, ask yourself a question, because, well, it's true what it says right here, we have no lasting city, we're looking for the city that is to come. That sounds like what we read in Hebrews 11, right? Always looking forward and never quite receiving the promise. But in chapter 12, it told us, actually, you have come to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem. So we might ask the question, which is it? Are we looking for the city that is to come, or have we already come to it? And the answer, of course, is both, right? It's what theologians call eschatological or kingdom tension, kind of tension of these two truths at once. Because the truth of the matter is this, the future toward which we are oriented, that future that we're waiting for, is actually breaking in to the present. The future is breaking into the present. The Christian life is not a matter of kind of waiting it out on earth in order that we go to heaven. We are not going to heaven. Heaven is breaking in on earth. And if you have questions about that, I'm happy to talk with you about that. That is the view of the biblical authors. Heaven is breaking in. God's rule and reign, the love, mercy, power, and justice of God are breaking in. When we listen and God speaks, heaven is breaking in. When we pray and God heals, heaven is breaking in. And when we pray and God frees someone, heaven is breaking in. And lives are transformed and whole communities are transformed. And as that happens in fits and starts, breaking in here in this earthly city and all around us is the heavenly city that is breaking in. This city here is becoming that city in the future as God's love and justice and power break into this place. The city that is to come, the city whose architect and builder is God, that city of which we understand ourselves by faith to be citizens, that city is both the one for which we are looking and the one to which we have come. And that is why the citizens of the heavenly city ought to be the very best citizens of this earthly city. Because we see the city of God breaking in from above, or more precisely, breaking in from the future. We see that city breaking in, and in fact, as we live by faith, we live oriented towards the assurance of things hoped for. We become agents through which the reality of what is hoped for actually breaks in to the present. In fact, that very first verse that we looked at a few weeks ago, and that definition of faith. Now, faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. That word that we've been translating, assurance, the Greek word there is often in other contexts translated reality or substance. So it's a double meaning and ambiguity, I think, actually built right into the text. Faith is the assurance of things hoped for, but it is also, as it engages with the reality of God breaking into the present, it is also the reality of what is hoped for, the very substance of the future breaking into the present. The presence of the future, as some have called it, heaven breaking in. And so as citizens of this city who live by faith, we can become, by God's grace, agents through which the reality of the future invades the present and healing and justice and transformation flow. And this earthly city can begin to look from one degree of glory to another a little bit more like that heavenly city. But as citizens of the heavenly city, we can become the very best citizens of this earthly city also because of what we are not, right? We are not, as we talked about a few weeks ago, beholden to the power structures of this city. As sojourners in a foreign land, we have no need to amass power or wealth or position in this place. And that means that we can live with a kind of incredible freedom and exhibit reckless generosity because we know God's promises to us, never to leave us or forsake us. And so we can live courageously, saying with the ancient preacher, "The Lord is my helper. I will not be afraid."
Fear, as we said at the outset, is quite often the opposite of faith. I will not be afraid. And so this is who we are called to become, as we are called to live by faith, to understand ourselves as citizens of that city that is to come. We are called to be the most generous, the most courageous citizens of this earthly city that the world has ever seen. You know, we've said this before around here, but it probably bears repeating in this context. God has not called us to build a great church. God has not just asked us to build a great church. God has actually called us to build a great city. God's called us to build a great city for all people. And I can't think of anything better for this city than a growing network of people following Jesus, confident of God's provision, committed to mutual love, practicing radical hospitality, nurturing strong families, helping New Haven become a great city for all people. And the beautiful thing is that God has, in fact, already designed such a great city. He's designed and built such a city. And that city is actually breaking into our present. It's breaking into this one. So let's orient our lives to that city whose architect and builder is God, and let's put ourselves on the front lines to celebrate its breaking in our city. Let's follow Jesus outside the city for the sake of the city. Let's follow Jesus outside the struggle for power and prestige in our world for the sake of our world. Let's lay down our selfish ambition and embrace the humiliation of Christ. Let's pay the cost of time, of money, of reputation, if need be. Let's consider them all nothing for the sake of the joy that lies ahead, the sake of the rule and reign of God that lies just over the horizon and is indeed already breaking into our present, if only we would allow ourselves to become the instruments of hope's realization. We all kind of become touch points for the presence of the future, for the thing that God has on the horizon.